Well, welcome everyone to Dallas Philosopher Forum. We are very glad you're here. We have a guest, a first-time visitor, Nancy. We want to welcome you, Nancy. You found out. You found out about us through our website. You just searched out Googling us. Okay. Well, we've got a bunch of old white guys in here. We like to have, you know, young, beautiful women come and help balance things out. And so we're really glad that you were here. We're dedicated to, as most of you know, we're dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to an interested audience in the DFW area. And we meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And if you haven't already paid yet, our esteemed philosopher slash treasurer, Dr. David Alcott, just pay him, it's $5. Any students here tonight? Any students at all? Okay, if you're a student, it's $2. If you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months worth of lectures, so it's a pretty good deal. And I also want to remind you to make sure you remember to pay your bill afterwards. Every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay. So we're a non-profit organization, and so please remember to take care of that bill. And if you need copies of our spring schedules on our website, www.philosophersforum.org, or David, we've got some copies, the green sheets, we've got some copies as well. And we are working diligently at lining up some top flight professors for philosophy for the fall. We've got a couple of UNT philosophy professors lined up so far, and so another one from University of Dallas lined up for the fall. Josh Perrins, Dr. Perrins, yeah, he's going to be speaking in December. And so, anyway, also, if you want to get updates on our meetings, that's available through meetup.com as well. And we're also looking, if someone wants to get involved to help us out on AV, help us out on social media, then we are looking for volunteers. And so if anyone's interested in that, that savvy in social media and marketing, we would really appreciate that. Okay, so lastly, I'll ask you to turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate. Now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Oh, I'm sorry, David. Yes, please come up. Pardon me. I forgot all about that, about our summer program.
Does anybody need a program for the remaining three lectures? A word about our summer program, Philosopher's Jeopardy, and we're going to have some fun. We have wrapped it up. TCU, SMU, and UD to field teams, and they'll compete with one another. And we're going to give them cash prizes, donations to their departments, and which brings up a subject of money. We're asking for sponsorships or little ads, you know, to put in the little program that we can hand out that night. And so far, we have pledges of $600, and we're asking for $50 or $20 donations, $100 if you want to. And this is for a good cause. It's you know, we're not making any money here. It's going to go to the for prizes for the philosophy department. So if anybody has, if the spirit moves you, please see me, and I will put you down in the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
What is an example of a prize?
Of a what?
A prize.
The cash prize.
Some of that money, hopefully, would be for scholarships for philosophy students.
Okay, but what's that convening about?
Oh, it's going to be set up like Jeopardy, and we're going to have a an MC or Master of Ceremonies or whatever host. It's going to be David Drum, and he will answer ask answers like the Jeopardy, and they will have to reply as a question on subjects of philosophy. And it's going to be set up electronically in different categories. Help me, David. Greeks.
Probably Greeks, Germans, existentialists, so forth.
Yeah. Modern philosophers.
That sort of thing. And they'll pick a, you know, a 300 thing, just like Jeopardy. And they'll, you know, press a buzzer to see who can answer. So it'll be kind of fun. And they'll, you know, compete with one another. And so we'll have a first, second, and third prize. And they can have bragging rights.
What's the sexy kind of, like, eroticism in philosophy, maybe? Something like that? Come up with some sexy topics.
Brian. Oh, it's going to be on the SMU campus, July 22nd. And do we have a venue, David?
I don't know the rig yet.
We do have one of the professors in the philosophy department is helping us find a place. It's on the SMU campus for sure.
I thought philosophers would never give you answers. They only ask questions.
Well, that's what they have to ask the question.
That's right. See, they have to ask the question.
The question, asking the question is the answer. Okay, great. Thank you, David. Okay, I'd now like to introduce our speaker. We're very privileged to have Dr. Frank Scalabrino with us tonight. Dr. Scalabrino is currently a visiting affiliate assistant professor at the University of Dallas. This semester he's teaching a course on the philosophy of being and recent philosophy. Dr. Scalabrino received his MA in philosophy from Kent State University and his PhD in philosophy from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. There's a lot of philosophers that come out of Duquesne, including Dr. Berman here as well, Director Emeritus, Dallas Philosopher's Forum. Dr. Scalabrino's area of expertise includes recent philosophy, philosophy of psychology, the history of philosophy, and metaphysics. Dr. Scalabrino has also published extensively in these same areas, and I took a look at your data, and it's like 5 or 6 pages long. There's even a presentation that you made last year on the metaphysics of Van Gogh's style. So he'll be coming back tomorrow night to be speaking about the metaphysics of Van Gogh's style. But I'd like to hear more about that. That would be very interesting. Van Gogh and God, wasn't that the subtitle of it or something? Van Gogh and God, that sounds fascinating. He'll be speaking this evening on anchoring, imaginative variation, and existential phenomenology on the problem of naturalizing content in the philosophy of psychology. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Frank Scalabrino.
Okay, well, check me out here. See.
You should be on.
I'm on?
No, yeah.
I'm sure. All right. Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm very happy to get to share the evening with you. And I'm hoping that you're going to enjoy what I've prepared for you. I want to say a couple things by way of sort of disclaimer on the way in. I wasn't exactly sure the mix I was going to have in the audience, right? So I couldn't gear it to the level that maybe you would like, but hopefully the discussion, et cetera, will get us all on the same page if you have questions afterward. The other piece I'd like to mention up front is I have a handout for you. So this paper probably should only last somewhere in the neighborhood of about 25 to 30 minutes. Might not need it. It's probably only going to last somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 minutes or so. But then I have a handout to give you that in going through the handout, this should then start facilitating the discussion. And so I see this as a kind of three-part process. Let's see. And then the last thing that I'll mention is that this is a very exciting period of time for me right now. I find myself on a kind of sprint right now, so to speak. I've been writing since Thursday, and basically only stopping to teach, eat, and sleep. So I'm a little bit. I've got a little bit of an edge going on here, but hopefully you won't even notice. So excellent. Okay, so you were given the abstract beforehand, and so would you prefer that I read the abstract, or you would prefer that I not read the abstract going in?
Go ahead, read it again.
Read it again. Okay, I'll read the abstract and the refresh your memory. Okay, so what we may call the primary, what we may call the primary question problem complex today in the philosophy of psychology and cognitive science involves the interpretation of data regarding various human brain states. At the forefront of this question problem complex is a tension between first person and third person perspectives. Beyond material, naturalistic, and normative behavioristic approaches, which may seek to eliminate first person perspectives, my thesis seeks to interpret the data while at the same time affirming the first person perspective. My thesis differs from other approaches which affirm the first person perspective in a number of ways. Most noticeably, I suggest a shift from a Cartesian, Husserlian-based vocabulary, which heavily relies on the term consciousness, to an existential, Heidegger-based vocabulary, invoking terms such as being in the world. However, I got to say, I just finished writing an article on Sartre over the weekend, and so you might hear me throwing consciousness around a little bit this evening, even though in this way, I argue for an interpretation of the data in terms of a being's mnemonic grasp of its environment by critically discussing eliminative interpretations of the data and the psychological activities of anchoring and imaginative variation. My non-eliminative position differs from similar positions in the emphasis I place on memory and the manner in which I link memory and fundamental ontology. Simply put, I argue memory goes all the way down, and I articulate being in the world as a transcendental unity which mnemonically encompasses empirical aspects indicated by brain states. Okay, sure. So, simply put, I argue that memory goes all the way down. Philosophers like to throw that kind of language around every once in a while. And I articulate being in the world as a transcendental unity which mnemonically encompasses empirical aspects, and those empirical aspects are indicated by brain states. This, I'm going to explicate this throughout. If you want to know how I came to this, the way that I came to this was actually through an intensive study of Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. And this will come out in the handout as we begin to talk and look at the handout together. But basically, if you're looking at the Critique of Pure Reason, and I highly recommend that if you haven't already read the Critique of Pure Reason, that you pop it out and just kind of look at it to get a feel for the mind involved that created the Critique of Pure Reason. It's just absolutely beautiful. But one of the ways that, very quickly here, one of the ways that the Critique of Pure Reason is often discussed is that the suggestion is that the Critique of Pure Reason stands or falls on a section titled The Transcendental Deduction. And in the Transcendental Deduction, Immanuel Kant had to figure out a strategy basically for combining what he refers to as the let's see if I can, I wonder.
You're coming through.
I'm coming through, okay?
Yeah, you're
coming
through.
We can hear you. Go right in front.
Okay. Some folks are gesturing as though they can't hear me, so how about if not, I could probably hold the microphone.
No, that would be fine.
You can hear crank it. That was high.
You're okay. If you're okay, I'm okay.
Right.
Okay. So Immanuel Kant's suggestion in order to solve the problem of the transcendental deduction, which is how basically, I'm playing with his language here a little bit, is to how to combine sense perception with concepts. The question, you could put it, we could formulate it in a number of different languages, we could say, or vocabularies, we could say in Aristotle's De Anima, it's the problem of how to combine the animal soul with the powers that the rational human, or the rational animal has access to. But you could also put it in terms of what is the power that's combining pre-reflective with reflective consciousness in Sartre as well. So, yeah. so we can see this over and over again. The usual way to solve that problem, the usual way that philosophers solve that problem is by suggesting that the power of imagination solves that problem. So the idea is that in the Critique of Pure Reason, there's a kind of productive imagination such that, I'll put it to you like this, such that your senses, your sensory, what just say your senses are filled right now, right? You're hearing things, you're seeing things, you're feeling things, you're tasting things and smelling things. Mm-hmm. And some power in your soul has to unify all of that information, right? Because otherwise, you would be very confused right now, right? You'd be sort of trying to follow all of the input all at once. So the idea is that there has to be a power that unifies all this input and that allows you to focus on it, but then also there has to be a way in which concepts, the discursive mind, can link up with the product of this unification. So Kant basically suggests that the power of imagination is pulling together all of your senses and projecting this image, what we want to think of it as a full kind of image because it's filled with sensory content. And the idea here is that imagination then solves the problem of the transcendental deduction. And so if you accept imagination as this power, then you believe that the critique of pure reason stands. I like what Kant says about the power of imagination. By the time he gets to the third critique, it's extremely beautiful, the stuff he's able to do with the power of imagination. However, my suggestion is that the way he talks about memory is just not powerful enough, given all of the memory research that we have now, especially, for example, the research coming out of Dr. Tolving and Dr. Schachter. Dr. Schachter out with his memory lab in Harvard. So anyway, once you start thinking about the power of memory, my suggestion is that you can trace a kind of trajectory through what Kant refers to as the transcendental deduction. You can trace it by the power of memory. So we talk about sense memory, we talk about declarative memory and procedural memory, and the idea is that you can use this to bridge the transcendental deduction just perhaps even more easily than imagination. Okay, so forgive me, I guess we're going to be able to fill the time pretty easily. So I'll go ahead and jump into the paper. We'll see, I think that the paper is really pretty straightforward, so we'll see if you have questions or you need some clarification, I'm happy to do it. All right, so this paper has three main sections then, and I'll announce each section as it comes on the horizon here. So the first, I establish existential phenomenology as the context within which the main thesis of the paper is to be understood. Second, I indicate what is meant by, quote, the problem of naturalizing content in the philosophy of psychology, end quote. And then lastly, I provide a synthetic reading of aspects emphasized from the first two parts of the paper in support of the paper's main thesis. And in other words, with this paper, I set out to articulate a number of arguments against eliminative strategies for solving the problem of naturalizing content. And generally, these strategies are associated with psychophysical identity theories of mind. Very quickly, I'm going to go into this, but this might provide a little bit more context. A psychophysical identity theory of mind suggests that there are mental properties and there are physical properties. And the psychophysical identity theory just says that basically the mental properties are the physical properties. They directly reduce down, right? So you can, in other words, you can identify the mental properties with the physical properties. And so this question of the relationship, this question of the relationship between the mental properties and the physical properties is going to be sort of central to what we're talking about. There are a number of different strategies. I have three different strategies on this handout that I'm going to share with you. There are a number of different strategies for approaching this. As we were talking beforehand, I want to affirm phenomenology. We can't abandon phenomenology, obviously. But at the same time, we've got to take the neuroscience into consideration. All right, so this is the first section. It's titled Imaginative Variation. I begin then with a quote from Franz Brentano. I really like this quote because I think it gets right at it. So it's a lengthy quote. Quote, there is no question, this is Brentano, there is no question that in sensing we have two objects. One is called the external object, the other the inner object. Aristotle said of the latter that we sense it incidentally, and as a result, the external object was called the primary object and the inner one the secondary object. So on the one hand, Brentano is emphasizing the distinction between our psychological representation and that which it represents. On the other hand, this distinction allows us to analyze the psychological representation into its constitutive parts. Aristotle is also instructive regarding our analysis in that Aristotle's De Anima, by indicating rationality as the specific difference between humans and non-rational animals, indicates that an experiential representation's composition includes both non-rational and rational parts. In Brentano's language, sensory and noetic aspects, respectively. So again, number of different vocabularies here, same theme, how to link up the products of sense perception with concepts of the understanding. Now, what we want to keep in mind is that the having of a psychological representation, of course, is the very having with which we identify the external object. And the identity of the external object will play no small role, will play no small part if we are to ask how brain activity is correlated with brain external reality. This is the case since we cannot answer the question of, quote, to what, end quote, brain activity is correlated if we do not have a what of experience. And every having of a what is a having of a psychological representation. In Brentano's vocabulary, the psychological representation is the inner object. Focusing then on the composition of the psychological representation, we notice that the conceptual content unifies the sensory content. That is to say, input from our senses constitutes a kind of swirling chaos insofar as through our senses we are open to the environment in a non-focused way. Yet when we begin to identify what is in the environment, we selectively unify sensory input under concepts. This allows me to focus on the chair in the corner of the room. This allows me to focus on the chair in the corner of the room, despite sensing my shoes on my feet, the temperature of the room, and sounds as far as my ears can reach. However, in itself, this focusing of sensory input under a concept may not be sufficient to rule out the possibility of a direct correspondence between external object and internal representation. For example, it may be said that the totality of sensory input to the representation, may be correlated with brain activity, such that through a process of experimental elimination, the identity of the object may be correlated with some limited amount of brain activity. Rather, the way in which we will come to see that an identity of direct correspondence between brain activity and representation is mistaken is by examining how the sensory content goes through a process of conceptual focusing. Both the non-rational and the rational animal have the power of imagination. Imagination here is not to be merely confused with the power of sight. Rather, imagination is to be thought of in terms of the power which unifies sensory content into a perceptual image. This understanding is consistent with the history of psychology, and we are in agreement, for example, with Aristotle and Kant, among others. Hence, we may think of the power of imagination as the top of the animal soul, and as such, it is the power responsible for producing images of focused sensory input to be combined with concepts from the rational soul. Under a concept provided by the power specific to the rational soul, a further focusing of perception culminates in conceptual identification. Notice then, to sum, the psychological process through which a human goes in order to identify an aspect of its environment through its senses is at least twofold, in that one, a perceptual focusing is finally conceptualized, and the conceptualization is the second part. Yet as we will soon see, we will be able to isolate even more folds or moments in this process. Okay, so this is the next section, is called From Synchronic to Diachronic Analysis. Thus far, our analysis of the inner object or psychological representation has been synchronic, meaning we have merely been looking at one moment in time. However, once we take up the representation in a diachronic analysis, we must ask the question of how time relates to the process through which a human goes in order to identify an aspect of its environment. In asking this question, we see that through the involvement of memory at both the perceptual and conceptual levels, the past and the future are folded into the process. At the perceptual level, memory functions to filter out sensory input not related to the perceptual focusing by, for example, retaining aspects to be formed by imagination. Further, memory contributes to the process through anticipation. Now, since the power of anticipation is central to both imaginative variation and the thesis of this paper, I will discuss it further in a moment. Memory, at the conceptual level then, involves the traditional storehouse notion of memory, such that thinking through the objects identified in the environment will depend to some extent on the kind of vocabulary with which one is working. And that, of course, means what terms one has stored in memory that can be recalled. To be clear, I am not saying that one cannot identify a chair as conceptually distinct from a table unless they have a specific vocabulary. Rather, I am suggesting that the conceptual richness of an individual's representation of a chair will depend upon the specific vocabulary they recall. I imagine someone who works in a furniture store and sells chairs could probably say much more about a chair than what I could. Okay. In regard to memory's involvement in the activity we call anticipation, we should be able to see the difference between a kind of experiential, and that is perceptual, anticipation, and conceptual anticipation. At the conceptual level, if I say ice cream, you may think of various concepts related to ice cream. Like, for example, cone, or the name of some ice cream vendor. However, at the perceptual level, anticipation involves the retention in memory of the task at hand. Simply put, perceptual anticipation relates to the purpose of the activities in which we engage. Notice, anticipation, then, is intimately involved in the human process of identifying external objects in the environment. Otherwise, we might forget what we were doing before completing the task. For example, think of the complexity involved in identifying one's relation to the environment and one's feeling as a kind of sluggishness that calls for a cup of coffee. Sluggishness itself does not necessitate a cup of coffee. Rather, on the one hand, it depends on the purpose of your activities at the time as to how you follow the identification of sluggishness. And, on the other hand, just as sluggishness itself does not necessitate its consequent action, so too the completion of the action from sluggishness through its consequent action depends upon the retention and the determined purpose. Otherwise, again, you forget in the process. At this point, we may now be able to understand what phenomenologists mean when they speak of imaginative variation. Given what we have already noted, in the process of identifying various objects in the external environment, it is possible for humans to use the power of imagination to vary how sensory input is focused into a perception. This, of course, will relate to how the perceptual is ultimately conceptually identified. However, at this point, we want to stay with the perceptual events. Chairs become stepping stools, weapons, affectionate locations, or obstacles. And my engagement with them as such diachronically depends on my power of anticipation. So imaginative variation refers to the ability to suspend or neutralize the perceptual focusing related to the environment. Such suspension of the process allows us to relate to what we would otherwise consider the same object in different ways. I can pick out one object from the environment and vary my way of perceiving it. or I can focus on the environment in ways which involve the overlap or combination of objects. Similarly, the manner in which imaginative variation links with conceptual identification relates to what existential phenomenologists associate with hermeneutics. For example, Martin Heidegger spoke of the hermeneutic as, A-S, to indicate that our seeing of the environment is a seeing as. In other words, when we have arrived at a conceptually identified representation to keep in mind, this is to keep in mind, that our representation constitutes a kind of interpretation of the environment. This is a very long sentence, forgive me, let me start that over. In other words, when we have arrived at a conceptually identified representation to keep in mind that our representation constitutes a kind of interpretation of the environment, is to keep in mind the process which ran through a kind of imaginative variation to arrive at the object as the what we take it to be. I love these long sentences. I don't know why I do that. okay, so, yeah.
You sound like a German.
Yeah, it is. It's true. So, affirming the representation as a kind of interpretation, okay? Affirming the representation as a kind of interpretation affirms not only the process as a kind of hermeneutic involving our pre-understandings and anticipatory projects, but also affirms the process of selection at a perceptual level, which was also accomplished in light of potential variations, both imaginative and anticipatory. Let me pause for a second before I start this next section and just give you a quick example here, right? So if, I know this is somewhat absurd, but I think the point will come across. A philosophy professor has to use absurd examples, right? But so, were a lion to come through the room, and we hope it doesn't, but were a lion to come through the room, we might immediately sort of reach for a chair to use as a kind of device to defend ourselves, or a sort of lion-taming device of the chair, right? This is the idea of prior to the lion coming in the room, you might not be relating to that object that you would call a chair in such a way, right? So at the same time, if we decided we needed to reach the ceiling for some reason, suddenly objects in the environment would light up for us in different ways than the way that they're already lighting up for us in our natural attitude, we might say. But the idea is that we want to come to realize that in our natural attitude, we have arrived at the identification of those objects through the same process that we can see whenever we change the identification of those objects, right? So it's not as though we want to say, it's not as though I have a sort of process that I go through when I have to change it, but we want to say I go through that process whenever I have identified it to begin with as well. Okay. All right, so this is the next section, the problem of naturalizing content. I wasn't paying attention to that glass of water until I needed to drink. The problem of naturalizing content. In this second part of the paper, the leading question is, what is meant by the problem of naturalizing content? A sharp distinction should be drawn between brain localization of function and the physicalist project. The physicalist project parasitic on the success of localization of function project, okay, that seeks to correlate, the physicalist project seeks to correlate brain activity with experientially related aspects of an organism's environment. This latter project can be further distinguished into the project of naturalizing semantic content versus naturalizing a reduced version of semantic content, that is, semantic content reduced to perceptually identified environmental objects. I've got some actual examples here that we're going to look at, so it should be even clearer. The reduced version of semantic content avoids the hermeneutic critique of meaning-making, since it explicitly strives to correlate the representation reduced in form prior to its semantic determination through rationalization. In Aristotelian terms, this is like correlating the environmental object as it is apprehended by the animal soul. Ultimately, the problem with this strategy will be, as we will see, stems from assumptions about the process through which such a representation is constructed. An excellent example of correlating a reduced version of semantic content of experience may be seen in the physicalist notion of a brain object. And I'm referencing some research of one of my acquaintances because it's just such a cavalier statement of this position. I really like picking on it. But they're good folks. They're very good folks. So, for example, Liz Swan and Lewis Goldberg explain what is meant by a brain object through reference to the work of neuroscientist Miguel Nicolelli. The specific research from Nicolelli in question involves monitoring a learned response in rats to their environment. That is to say, the rats are placed in an environment which includes various openings into which they may stick their snout. In doing so, the whiskers of the rats are bent by making contact with the frame of the opening in controlled ways, since all of the openings are either a wide or narrow dimension. Okay? The uniformity of the effect on the whiskers of the rats allows the rats to perceptually discern through their whiskers the way in which where the walls hit their whiskers, right? Whether narrow or wide, through their whiskers, whether the aperture of an opening is of the wide or narrow kind. The rats then are trained to respond one way to a narrow aperture and a different way to a wide aperture in order to receive a reward for their responses. It, of course, logically follows that the nervous system activity of the rat can be associated in time with the perception of aperture, fueling the suggestion that the brain activity may be paired with the meaning of the aperture for the rat. The brain activity, it is suggested, may be paired with meaning here, since a rat's encounter with the aperture is taken to be meaningful for it insofar as it has learned its subsequent response. That is to say, the learned response is supposed to evidence the meaning of the pairing of brain activity with an organism's perception in time, and the concept of brain object refers to this pairing. Now, this is an example of the physicalist strategy of correlating a reduced version of semantic content, because the so-called meaning of the animal's experience is taken to be embedded in the perception itself, without the need of recourse to any further system extending in time. On the one hand, this would be like analyzing human experience as meaningful in a moment prior to the human comprehension of the meaning of the experience in an extended semantic way, for example, as amplified through language. Especially since the neuroscience here is dealing with the environmental experiences of non-rational animals, the attempt to identify a moment of reduced semantic content is not the strategy's flaw. On the other hand, it is clear that the strategy for identifying a brain object depends on the researcher's ability to index a rat's experience in terms of temporality. Hence, it will be the physicalist assumptions regarding time that will turn out to be the flaw in the strategy. Notice, a brain object is determined by a correlation identified not by what is correlated, but by when the brain activity is occurring in time. In other words, the meaning of the brain activity is determined by its correlation with the rat's activity at that time. Further, the rat's activity at that time is taken to be meaningful due to its relation to a learned response observed later. In other words, the brain activity of the rat paired with its action of perceiving the narrow aperture is supposed to be contained in the brain object. And this brain object is supposed to be meaningful to the rat given the evidence of what occurs at another moment in time, since the subsequent behavior evidences the rat's learned response. So the correlation of brain activity with time is not up for questioning here. The content of the perception, that is, the meaning of the brain object, is. In a word, the physicalist strategy in seeking a reduced version of semantic content uncritically assumes a non-adumbrated, and we can talk about this later, but a non-adumbrated version of perception. This is of no small consequence, since the question of adumbration is exactly the question of the meaning content of perception. Put another way, even if granted non-semantic concept, it is not clear that the apprehended object to be correlated with the brain is not adumbrated. By adumbrated, I mean what existential phenomenologists mean. That is, perception of an object involves a composition of partial perceptions in such a way that the psychological composition resists either a correspondence with physicality or a temporal isolation. This will be the focus then in the final section below. And if we need more time on adumbration, we'll talk about adumbration. Okay, so this is the final section. It's called Anchoring and Imaginative Variation. So I kind of illustrated what I take to be the problem, and I'm going to try to show you how there might be a way to, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, with either set of bathwaters here. Okay, so anchoring and imaginative variation. Consider the manner in which, while multitasking, we may accomplish activities without remaining in complete conscious control of each aspect of each activity. Put another way, we can accomplish tasks without consciously focusing on every aspect of the task. This is not to suggest that the rats in Nicolelli's experiments were distracted by their cell phones. Rather, this is to suggest that the assumption of an identity between the meaning of a task and the perceptual focus of the organism accomplishing the task is unnecessary. Yet, this is not the full thrust of the criticism of the physicalist reduction of semantic content strategy. The thrust of the criticism concludes from the critique of the organism's focus that even with a semantically reduced understanding of the meaning of an organism's action, the assumption that the meaning of the action be physically instantiated as a totality seems unwarranted. All of this may come to light through a discussion of adumbration and anchoring. The idea gained by meditating on adumbration is simply that we do not perceive objects in the environment from all possible angles in all possible sense modalities simultaneously.
Of course.
Right. Well, you'll see, wait till you look at this research. Rather, we achieve a kind of perceptual wholeness related to the object through a series of adumbrations. In other words, encountering various aspects of objects perspectivally and through limited sense contact, we apprehend objects of the environment as meaningful for us. Recall, this is still at the level of perceptual activity. That is to say, we need not examine the semantic meaning of objects for the characterization of an organism's relation to its environment as adumbrated to be true. It remains then to be seen what this understanding of adumbration means in relation to an organism's learning and the temporal critique gestured toward above. First, in regard to the rat's learning the meaning of the size of the aperture evidenced by its subsequent actions, it seems at least equally plausible to characterize the sequence of events in terms of anticipatory association. In other words, the rat's learning of the meaning of the aperture may be alternatively characterized as the rat's ability to associate some perceptual aspect with the anticipation of a subsequent perceptual aspect of its environment. The specific difference between the two different characterizations being that the brain object would now be better labeled as a brain part object. So the part referring, of course, not to a part of the brain, but to a part of the meaningful object of the environment. Further, this part would be the physically instantiated part. Hence, if asked where is the whole object physically instantiated, the answer would extend not semantically, but temporally. And yet none of this suggests that the whole object would ever be physically instantiated in brain activity, even across time. to clarify this a bit further, notice that what matters in the rat's supposed having a meaningful relation to its environment is precisely that, its relation. In other words, there is no need to assume that the character of the relation entail the totality of the environmental object supposed to be apprehended. Think of how it is possible to relate to a non-present object by anticipating its presence in the future. Didn't I order a drink? Characterized in terms of physical instantiation, aspects of what is present may be associated with what is not present. Just as something beyond the mere physical presence of the organism must persist if we are to suggest the evidence of learning is actually evidence of learning, so too the environmental object to which the organism relates need not be physically instantiated as much as the sensory discrimination through which it orients to the environmental object be physically instantiated. In this way, the whole object may be accessed only through a passing of time in such a way that the object never appears in its totality in any one moment in time. I'm talking about the representation. Hence, an organism's learning to orient to its environment may be characterized in terms of relational associations instead of whole objects totally present at all times in the mind of an organism experiencing its environment. Okay, second, imaginative variation is often tied up with this very notion of adumbration. In other words, it is possible to encounter aspects of the environment and vary the way one understands the objects these aspects may identify. You see how I'm pulling these things together now. So just as the above examples regarding a chair shows how we identify the quantity and shape of the physical mass in our environment. Let me start that sentence over. Just as the above examples regarding a chair shows how we identify the quantity and shape of the physical mass in our environment will not be by experiencing it from all sides simultaneously. Rather, our perception will be adumbrated, and further, how we encounter it will entail our anticipatory relation to it. So I started off by talking as though we had these anticipatory relations to whole objects, and now we're sliding into this talk as though, well, what we actually have is anticipatory relations to part objects, or to an adumbrated object. That is to say, do I need to tame a lion, sit down, or change a light bulb just now? As I survey my environment from the angle and position at which I am located, the adumbrated perspectival and sensory access I have to objects in the environment will allow me, through the various associations of which I am capable, to accomplish finding a place to sit or changing a light bulb, for example. And this, of which I am capable, is very important because, on the one hand, it depends upon skill, and we could say, on the other hand, it depends upon experience, just like the concepts involved with someone who, for example, sells furniture could probably say more about a chair than me. So, in other words, all of these examples point to memory. Right? Notice the phrase, various associations of which I am capable, in pointing to my own most potentialities, further emphasizes the way in which the phenomenology involved here is existential. Finally, adumbration and imaginative variation, though critical of the brain object, do not fully annihilate the brain activity being investigated. Hence, I conclude this paper with an alternative characterization of the brain activity. My alternative characterization of the brain activity is in terms of memory. Specifically, the brain activity to be associated with the apprehension of objects may be characterized as a kind of anchoring. Anchoring, in terms of memory, is very much like the everyday understanding of the term. That is to say, at the level of apprehension, that is, prior to semantic content, the brain activity may be understood as the organism's way of anchoring its relation to aspects of the environment. Part objects. In this way, the organism may be seen orienting itself in both space and time. The spatial orientation may relate to the adumbrated physicality of the environment, while the temporal orientation relates to the manner in which the organism is constructing through associations toward an environmental object. Is that a stepping stool? Is it for taming lions? Is it a chair for sitting on? Hence, the brain object, supposed to be correlated with the meaning of the aperture, becomes more dynamic, in that the organism is not merely statically encountering meaningful whole objects in the environment. Rather, an organism encounters aspects of the environment which have apprehended meaning, grounded in relations, both spatial and temporal. This is the conclusion. Our discussion today has shown that it is a mistaken assumption upon which the physicalist strategy is based. Namely, the physicalist wrongly assumes that the apprehended meaning of an object can be physically instantiated in brain activity in two ways. First, it seems incorrect to assume that the meaning of the apprehended object need be present in its totality in each or even a moment of perceptual activity. Second, it seems incorrect to assume, even at the level of apprehending meaning, that the meaning for the organism of its perceptual content be grounded physically and spatially so as to include what will be lived existentially by the organism through time. In other words, it seems more correct to say that the brain activity relates both to the organism's spatial and temporal experience, and the determination of meaning through time resists the physical spatial localization of meaning.
Most excellent. Questions, Bob?
And I have a handout for you that actually shows a graphic from the research that I was looking at. And if there is time, we could talk about this very quickly. And then we could start questions if you'd like, or we can start it now. Yes.
Yeah, well,
yes.
You started out drawing out the concept of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
and I agree with everything you said, and I think it's all based on consciousness, because consciousness is not a thing. Consciousness is a process. And the process that you just described is exactly what consciousness does. So, what you have done, I think you've done an excellent job, is advance our understanding of how consciousness works and how it relates to the things in themselves. So, I would suggest you rethink that the consciousness is, because it's not a thing. People, make a thing out of consciousness. It's not. It's a process. And you have described the process. That is exactly what consciousness does. That would be my suggestion.
Yes. No, thank you very much. Yeah. I really appreciate your comments. And the reason, I think you're already attuned to this, and you're indicating this to me as well, but the reason I try to avoid the word consciousness, although, the more Sartre I keep going back to, the more I'm feeling like I know, which is great. It's great. But the reason I want to try to avoid that term is because, and you'll see it here in the handout, is that my suggestion is that it masks the complexity. So on the one hand, it's, as you're saying, it's a person could take it to be a thing instead of a process, but even in taking it to be a process, I want to say that it's a process of a multiplicity. And when you call it one thing like consciousness, it seems to suggest that it's not a multiplicity, even if the person takes it as a process. So, but you're absolutely right, and that's exactly
right. It's not a thing, and that's the mistake that everybody makes.
Yes.
We have a question.
Sure.
From what you've been saying, I keep on thinking that you're sort of describing what it's like to recall a song. You recall the first few phrases of the song, and the rest of it you don't recall in the entirety, but as you progress, the rest of it comes to you. And I think we have that capability in our minds of recording temporal sequences piecemeal. But I'm not sure that animals don't, actually. I suspect that in mating behavior, for instance, between birds, is some of them go on for an hour or two between penguins and so on. And again, they're going through sequences that probably aren't conscious in their entirety at one point.
Excellent. Yeah, so I think I'm in agreement with you about the animals. So for example, I think the mistake that's being made, and we can, again, if we look at the handout here, we can see how they're talking about this. But the mistake that's being made is the assumption that there has to be an isomorphic relation between the psychological representation and the physical object in the world. And so, that's a mistaken assumption. So, but it's the kind of assumption that allows you to think then that, again, that the meaning of the object is present in a totality. But I'm actually in agreement with you about when you hear, for example, when you hear a portion of a song, right, we want to say you can then relate to it meaningfully without the totality of the song being present. In fact, I'm not even sure what it would mean to say that the totality, you know, somebody play the entire song in one blast or something. You know. So, yeah.
I think scientists talk in terms of models. The scientist describes the reality around him in terms of some sort of very abbreviated model that can actually be reduced to a mathematical equation in many cases. And so that, I think our perceptions of reality are really like making models of the world we live in. And from the moment we're born, we are looking for patterns and making some sort of mental models of what's going on around us.
Yeah, no, so the idea is that we have this powerful technology. We're able to sort of witness the activity that's occurring in the nervous system, and the question becomes something like, how does that activity, how do these physical properties, we might say, how does this activity relate to the content of the organism's experience, right? So the question becomes, when you're trying to relate, and if we go back to the language that I used earlier, if you're just trying to ask the question of how do the physical properties relate to the mental properties, right? To begin with, there's a sense in which we have to be able to correctly characterize the mental properties. And insofar as the scientists are trying to characterize the mental properties as referring to these whole objects, then we're saying, well, this in itself is problematic. So my suggestion is that we can reduce it to a kind of relation to the physical. I have my physical body in a physical environment, and my relation to other physical beings in the environment, we would say, is characterized by the mental properties that are going to be either sensory perceptive or conceptual or both. And so the idea is that we don't want to import the assumption that as I'm coming into contact with these physical entities in the environment, we don't want to import the assumption on the one hand that I have the whole meaning already because there's a process involved in arriving at that meaning, and it depends on my existential constitution in the environment, but then also we don't want to say that I have the whole object perceptually even, right? Because not only am I coming to it in an adumbrated way, but the way in which I relate to it as adumbrated is going to depend upon my existentiality as well.
Okay, we have a question here.
Yeah. Great point.
Yes, I can follow most of what you said. It could also be related as to learning processes, a stimulus response, a chain of these events. Now, I want to take this a degree further. The large part of what you referred to is individual perception. Now, social consensus about what we perceive in our society is a very major problem. It goes, you know, beyond the individual perception. How do you apply this to arriving at a consensus in, say, a society?
Well, on the one hand, I agree with your assessment. However, I mean, I like to emphasize this sort of postmodern historical period that we're in, or perhaps to blame pragmatism. There's a number of different ways that we can take it up, but how to solve that? Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I prepared something in terms of philosophy of psychology and existential phenomenology for you, but if I were to address that topic, I would probably talk about either postmodernism or pragmatism, but I don't have a quick, easy answer. Yeah.
See, one of the dilemmas that occurs is of my individual perception. Oh, I can readily project that onto, say, another person. Mm-hmm. That's my perception. Mm-hmm. And these projections also are maybe very erroneous from that person's perception.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I mean, so we can, do you want to respond to this? Or do you want?
Well, all perceptions in that respect are just a result of agreement. We all agree that I see it this way. Do you see it that way? Yeah, I see it this way. What if I turn this way? Now do you see it the same way? Well, no. Well, come over here and you'll see it the way I see it. So that's what it is. There is no universal or societal perception. There's only individual perceptions.
Okay, sure. So I mean, the other way that we could take this up is we could say, I would invoke Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein and say something like, the question, and so this is not a happy answer, though, right? This is not a happy answer. But the question is something like, we can make a distinction between language games and forms of life. And so the forms of life refer to your practices that we engage in. And so the question becomes, if you're asking the question of consensus, the idea is that on what level are you asking for consensus? So the idea is that are you asking for us to agree verbally or within our language game, or is there a sense of which what we're really hoping for is an agreement in practice? So for example, notice how no one's interrupting me while I'm talking, right? But why is that? That's because you all have a certain kind of practice, and that practice that you're engaged in is what identifies this social situation. So sometimes, like for example, when I'm in the classroom and I'm talking about this, someone will raise their hand and I'll say, you know, this guy expects I'm going to ask him what he wants. Right? But notice there's a sense in which it's because we're engaged in a kind of practice. But the problem becomes, so you can reduce that practice down to societal and cultural kinds of practices, but the problem becomes whenever you get these incommensurate kind of practices. Right? So the idea is that, I'll be very quick, we can characterize this in a number of different ways, but it's like in Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle, it's like trying to convince a vicious person to feel guilty about something. Right? Or another way to put it is something like, if you enter into this postmodern mindset, and I know that this isn't what I'm talking about here, but let me very quickly, if you enter into this postmodern mindset in which the meaning in your language is reduced to your practice, then the idea becomes something like this. You enter into a realm in which you can't identify truth across forms of life. So the idea becomes, so this becomes very problematic. So what ends up happening is something like this, is that, I use this example, is that when you think that cannibalism is bad, when you think that cannibalism is bad, we want to say, that's just, that move is just a move in your language game that has evolved based on your practices. So the idea would be to say something like this, you have survived without having to be a cannibal, and so therefore your practices don't include cannibalism, and so your language game says cannibalism is bad. But if you were in an environment, right, in which you had to survive by being a cannibal, then your language game would include things like being a cannibal is okay. So then the problem is that when two different forms of life encounter each other, you're playing one language game and they're playing another language game, and they can't meet each other. So if you're talking about consensus and agreement, it depends upon what level you're talking on. But that's not, you know, forgive me, Bill, because that's, you know,
excellent. Okay. Yeah. Question.
Thank you.
I'm very comfortable with the notion of the consciousness as a process, and as I would long say, or really how I come to this, perception is a transactive experience. We're always involved in what we see. And however, my question is, in the East, and I'm thinking specifically in Zen Buddhism, there's this sense of the direct experience of our environment. And I'm wondering how you would describe, define that within the context that you've talked about tonight. And just to give a little bit of a hint of where I'm tending, that it is what is going on here, it is somehow transcending conceptual representation, so that we have more of a perception. Not to go too far.
Yeah, no. Okay. So, forgive me. Let me say before addressing this. Let me just say these are really great comments. These are really great comments.
We're a smart group here. Yeah,
no, I'm really happy about this. Thank you so much. So, and it's really funny because I had to reduce down what I was going to put in the handout, and what I had in the handout was exactly about Zen Buddhism. So I was like, oh well, they're not going to be interested in that. I'll pull it out. You can see I crammed the Gestalt figures in at the bottom on page 1 because I couldn't put them on page 2. But we'll talk about this in a second. But in regard to this process, you know, there's so many different ways, it seems to me, to characterize it. So anyone who has experienced a meditative state, right, it seems to me that there is a kind of experiential content to that meditative state. How to characterize what's going on, I mean, I want to say something like, so very, very quickly, 3 different characterizations. I want to say something like, what they're really doing is performing a phenomenological reduction. I think that's what they're really doing when they're getting into a meditative state. It's performing a phenomenological reduction and then just sitting there holding it, right? But the other way to put it is something like this, is that in Sartrean terms, we could say something like, I tend to dwell in my reflective consciousness. But the idea would be something like, it's my pre-reflective consciousness that's more in the world than my reflective consciousness.
Ah.
So the idea is something like, I'm walking around in this physical environment and determining meaning in many ways. It's like Thales and the well, right? I'm determining meaning in this sort of reflection of the situation, but it's very easy for this reflection of the situation to be disconnected with the actual physical environment. Forgive me. So the point is this. Is that if you've never been in a meditative state, it's worth trying to encounter. But if you sit and you just count your breaths, and of course the idea is that not to count over 5, or you'll get lost in accounting. If you just repetitiously count your breaths, you stay with your body. What you notice happens is that this discursive mind, or the conceptual, these concepts, there's a sense in which you notice it just moving on its own. Right? It just moves on its own. So if your question is how to characterize this in these terms, I would say, yeah, often it's the case that we can be carried away by the discursive mind. And I would say that being carried away by the discursive mind is a kind of being stuck in the natural attitude. And then the last characterization is something like this, is that there's a sense in which when you're able to watch your thoughts flowing without your conscious control of them, right? You're paying attention to your breathing, you're trying to stay in the now. It seems to me that there is a kind of separation. The phenomenologists talk about this in terms of time. There's a kind of separation between the lived now, or the standing now, as Heidegger might refer to it, the standing now and the now of clock time. And so what I would say is it's a kind of becoming aware of the standing now. I don't know if that answered any of what you said, so forgive me. But I
have a question back here. Okay.
Yes, I'd be interested to the extent you consider Whitehead influential on your ideas. I see some similarities between what you talk about and his notion of occasion, apprehending adjacent occasions, and then the process of concrescence is what you call anchoring or memory. So I'd be interested in your response on that.
Okay. Yeah, you know, so I'm not a Whitehead scholar. I've come into a little bit of contact with Whitehead through Russell, and I've come into contact with Whitehead through Gilles Deleuze. I really like the contemporary French thinkers. So I don't really have the Whitehead process vocabulary down. However, I would say that insofar as insofar as we can characterize reality as process, and insofar as then we can try to articulate a kind of vocabulary that relates to reality as process, as opposed to falling into these reflective, static conceptions, yeah, then I would say that we resonate with one another, yeah.
Bob, do you want to say
that? I just have a little thing on the same subject. The thing about Whitehead is that he's an idealist. And phenomenology does not deal with idealism or materialism. And so it's a different language, it's a different philosophy, and you cannot compare them.
Question here, okay. Most of what you've talked about tonight is psychology and neuroscience. And I guess that was part of philosophy in the days of Kant. There was no science of psychology or neuroscience in particular. So I see, you know, the brain is our work organ, and there is no consciousness without physical brain. But it's a really, really powerful organ. It takes, you know, all of the sensory input, interprets it, compares it to our memory bank, all, you know, so we can almost instantaneously make decisions about, you know, survival concepts, decisions, actions, etc. Now, my question is, how does language involve in this process? For example, tonight, all of our sensory input was these vibrations that come from your mouth to our ears, and we interpret them, you know, in these words to make, you know, concepts, some concrete like rats and some very abstract like aberrate. Rats, they have the vibrissi, you know, because, you know, going in a little dark, black holes, they can't see, all right? But they have no words for it. This is narrow, this is wide. We do. So tell me, in your process, you know, what language has to do with this?
Okay. Yeah, excellent. So what I would say is that the language links up with the, what I was referring to as the hermeneutic as, right? So on the one hand, we would say that when we have a perceptual experience, we are able to language it, but it's often the case that as we're having the perceptual experience, we're real-time languaging it, so to speak. But the other piece to that would be something like this, is that in the actual, so in this research that they're looking at, so this is the idea that I'm trying to critique, and I'm still answering you, I think, is that in the research, they're actually equating. I mean, it's a kind of psychophysical identification, but they're actually equating whatever's going on inside the animal mind with the meaning of its environment. And what I want to suggest is that that's much more complicated. And so their suggestion, in order to respond to your question, is that if we can bracket language, because the animal doesn't have language, then that should make it easier for us. So that's why they like, you know, the idea is that this is why it should be easier to look at an animal than it is to look at a human, because you don't have to deal with language. But I want to suggest that you're going to be up against the same problem. Language is just going to make it even more complicated.
One more question, Jack.
It's
Bob,
not language.
Bob, you can talk to him after the lecture.
Very good question, though. Very good question.
Okay, so my question sort of...
Consciousness is not language.
That's right. The animal, yes, that's right. Yes, I'm sorry, sir. Go ahead, I'm with you.
So I thought David was going to really get at my question. He sort of started there, but it's a little different. It seems like that, it was just sort of mentioned, you know, philosophy has gotten to this state where it's very expletive or elucidating what is going on in another field or two, and that there's sort of an ephemeral value to that in the sense that what we know is changing daily. So I'm kind of, you know, what the philosophers, does what they elucidate become somehow useful in the world? Does it result in therapeutic modalities that help people, or does it result in new medications or drugs?
Sure. Yeah. So this has to do with book six of Plato's Republic, right? But I want to say that yes, I think it's useful, and it's also important because it can drive the subsequent research, right? The sort of systematic theorizing that goes on could drive the subsequent research. So it is important. But it's interesting. So I like to say that the distinction between analytic philosophy and continental philosophy is already dead. I mean, they're already talking about post-analytic philosophy, et cetera. I won't go into all this, but when in regard to that 20th century distinction, right, we can say something like one of my philosophy professors used to love saying this. He used to say that the analytic philosophers think that the only value that there is for philosophers today is to stand outside the laboratory and to cheer. to cheer on the scientists, right? But I would say that distinction is over, and I think that especially if you're looking at psychotherapy, I think it has an efficacy in relation to the research. Yeah.
When I said that was the last question, I lied. Here's the last question. I've been reading about artificial intelligence, and you've been talking very eloquently tonight about creativity, imagination, brain research, cognitive research, and I read that some futurists say that artificial intelligence, e.g. robots, in 30, 50, 80 years will have the imagination and creativity of human beings and will transcend human beings perhaps. And I wanted to just get your thoughts on limitations of artificial intelligence. I know it's not your field per se, but it's relating to, you know, creativity within our hippocampus and imagination. I just wanted you to spend a couple minutes on that.
Sure. I would say something like necessity, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. And so it seems to me that we're talking about creativity, right? So it seems to me that if you don't have human needs, right, then you're probably not going to have the same kind of creative capacities as a human. I mean, this is even why we want to say something like, you know, that the artist needs a kind of life, the artistic life, et cetera. But let me just say, the only other thing I'd say about this is that I think that this is exactly the same kind of problem. We want to say it's inauthentic, right? It's the same kind of problem that, you know, if we're going to start getting into the idea that there are whole objects and everything sort of necessarily flows from object to object, then it becomes something like, you know, what is creativity in that kind of a conception of reality? And it seems as though it's too naive realism, even if we want to replace that with a kind of scientific realism. And so my ultimate point here is something like, As you begin to change the needs of the organism, this is of course why they have to starve these rats, right? But as you begin to change the needs of the organism, we're going to say something like, well, then that's going to change the way in which it relates to its environment.
Okay, let's do a round of applause.